everyone, and welcome to another episode of Rocket Talk Radio. Today, we have Mr. James French again in the studio, along with Dave Nordling and Richard Garcia. Today, we're going to talk about AmRock, and this is a part of our series, Before SpaceX.
Hello, Jim, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Our conversation today will be about the American Rocket Company in Camarillo, California. I believe what I understand the backstory was they were a startup in the 80s to build hybrid rockets as a launch vehicle for cheaper access to space.
That's correct.
Now, when did you join AmRock?
I joined AmRock basically about the time it started. George Koopman, he's the guy that founded it and was the president, but he really had no technical people working for him at that point. This was in 1986 sometime, and he was out recruiting, and apparently I had a reputation for being successful at getting things done at JPL, although I don't know why, but anyway, George looked me up and put a sales pitch on me. And I was pretty fed up with JPL. I'd been there for 19 years and was doing advanced studies of missions that I knew weren't going to fly. In fact, doing the same ones over and over again, and that kind of was getting on my nerves. So, long story short, after a little indecision on my part, I quit JPL and signed up with AmRock as vice president of engineering and chief engineer.
So where did George Koopman come from? Do you know what his pedigree was?
Not exactly I'm not sure where he was born and raised and all like that, although Chicago kind of comes to my mind, but I couldn't swear to that. But he was mainly an idea guy and a salesman, and his knowledge of rocketry was pretty rudimentary, which is okay as long as you recognize it. But he had gotten somewhere along the way, had been enamored of space travel, and he decided he wanted to start his own company and started raising money to that end, and that was ultimately what became AmRock. By the way, we were not in Camarillo. It was founded in the San Francisco Bay Area. And the first several months that I worked up there or worked with them, they were in San Francisco, and I was commuting up from Southern California.
So what was it that sold you about AmRock? I mean, what was the thing that made you leave JPL to think that AmRock was a venture worth taking?
Well, as I said, I was getting kind of tired of doing the same old studies. The planetary program was really in the doldrums, so we didn't look like we were going anywhere anytime soon. And I was doing advanced studies, and one day I was sitting at my desk working on a study of a rendezvous mission to a short period comet. Came by every 7 years, and I realized I'd done a study of that same comet 7 years ago, the last time it came by. It didn't fly then. It wasn't going to fly now. So I was kind of ready to leave. I was starting to look around, and I had become very much enamored of the idea of private enterprise in space going back several years before that. And watching the way the government screwed around with the space program and canceled some very excellent work that we were doing on Mars sample return way back then. And I was just kind of disgusted. I thought if we're ever going to get anywhere, we got to get the space program out of the hands of the government. Otherwise, we'll just be going around in circles. So anyhow, I was kind of vulnerable. But before George, somewhere probably around 82 or something like that, a bunch of people from Hollywood, not actors and no movie stars, but money people and lawyers put together a little company because they thought it would be a good idea to do private enterprise space launch vehicles. And they wanted to do it through JPL. like I said, somehow I had gotten a favorable reputation in the outside world. They call me up, and the guy introduces himself. I'm so-and-so. They tell me, you know how to get things at JPL. We want to build a private launch vehicle. We want JPL to do it for us. I sort of went, wow. What was funny about that is even though it's the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, they hadn't done any significant propulsion work for probably since around, the 50s. The 60s or thereabouts. The name was a hangover from when they did rocket research.
Right.
But anyway,
right.
So these people wanted JPL to do it. Well, I said, okay, I'll give that a run. That sounds good. So I worked the system at JPL as hard as I could for weeks and finally convinced a great number of associate directors and other influential people that maybe this was a good idea, a chance for JPL to get some roots in private enterprise, and it's something they could certainly do, even if they weren't doing actual rocket development at the time. There were still people that do out. So anyway, it was all going fine until the last approval meeting, which was with the director and all the assistant lab directors, and I made my pitch. And everything was going fine until this one guy, the ALD in charge of the Deep Space Network, stands up in his room.
Excuse me, the ALD?
Yes, Assistant Lab Director for the Deep Space Network. He stood up and he said very angrily, well, this is very well for all you other people, but it doesn't do a bit of good for my division, and I don't think we ought to do it. And he was so forceful that he made all the rest of them chicken out, so they dropped it, my dismay. I thought I had it sold, and I did, except for that one guy. Anyway, that was my first foray into private enterprise, so I suspect the word had gotten around about that, too.
Right. So
anyway, George picked me as the guy he wanted to do the technical side of this company.
That wasn't the Starstruck company, was it? I did some research on hybrid rocketry, and I think one of the founders had roots back in a prior company called Starstruck. I didn't know if that was...
I don't know what Starstruck was. I've heard that name. That was not the name here. These people were not... not a hybrid rocket guys at all. They wanted to build liquid propellant rockets.
Right.
And none of them were technical people or had any prior experience. I wish I could remember about Starstruck, but I don't remember anything with the name.
I think the common tie, I think, was George Koopman, but this is just me reading magazine articles from Popular Science. I think I remember reading that as a kid in my hometown barbershop as far back as I... Because I do remember that the Popular Science was something I enjoyed reading back then. Did you have anything to add, Richard?
Yeah, that company, Starstruck, I think you said it was, they did a sea launch of a hybrid rocket, and I remember reading about that.
So Starstruck did a sea launch of a hybrid rocket?
I don't know the details.
No, I think Richard was saying it was Starstruck, but I guess we really should just combine the conversation to AMROC, though. I mean, AMROC was founded on the principle of building hybrid rockets. I actually have a friend of mine at my company who worked for Eaton. Has a sample of AMROC's hybrid rocket fuel, those little triangular coupons that they had cast. Yes?
It wasn't anything very exotic. It's very similar to the rubber on the tread of your tires.
It feels that way, yeah.
That's exactly what it is. George used to like to go around showing it to people and say, well, our rocket fuel is proprietary. He loved the phrase secret herbs and spices. And damn it, George, it's just synthetic rubber.
Just all 29 herbs and spices.
Everything. George, everything had to have some drama and mystery and all like that. Even if it wasn't there, he'd find some.
Well, it definitely sounds like he was perfect for his role as a promoter for the company.
Well, up to a point. As you probably observed, there are people who are good at getting things started, and
right.
Then there ought to be somebody else take over. leader that knows how to run a real business. And that's where George was a classic example. He was a wheeler dealer and fast, smooth talker and all like that.
Right.
But, you know, his claim to fame, knowing how to run big projects, was he worked on the Blues Brothers movie as a sort of a expediter type. And okay. he had set up with the city of Chicago getting permission to drive that car off the top of this parking building, which you may remember from the movie.
I do remember that movie.
He said, I set that up with the city of Chicago, and I and says, I know how to run big projects. You haven't got a clue if you think that's a big project.
Right.
So anyway, I shouldn't diminish.
No.
He did start the company and get it started successfully.
Well, yeah, he did. And so what was Amrock after a range of products? Or I know they had worked up to getting a launch vehicle. That was their goal. But what can you tell us about your – I know your time there was relatively short, but I think you probably
– About a year and a half.
Right. And in that year and a half, what did you see at Amrock? I mean, what was the first things that they worked on?
Well – first thing was just to develop the technology of hybrid to reliable ignition, determining the regression rate of the fuel versus pressure and that sort of thing, which is a major issue with hybrids. You got to understand how fast, basically it's just a cylindrical drain with a cylindrical hole down the middle. So as it burns away, the hole gets bigger. There's more burning area, but on the other hand, it doesn't burn away as fast because the velocity of the gases over it, which basically erodes the molten rubber and drain it into the gas stream. So they even though the burning area over time probably goes up by about a factor of three, the thrust stays about the same. And so you got this kind of a tricky business to balance that.
Right.
But it works very well. You know, one of the things is that all hybrids are really simple to design, and it's never not as simple as it looks, to be sure. But on the other hand, it's not all that hard either. Bevin McKinney, one of the guys that worked there, one day he was down in the dumps because the engines were not doing well. We had all kinds of trouble with them. He says, he'd always been a little turned around saying, oh, hybrids are so simple, very easy to run, blah, 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 blah. One day, and just sort of dispiritedly, he says, yeah, these hybrids are really easy to run, but they sure are hard to run well.
Right.
And that's the point. It's you really have to know what you're doing and tune it up to get decent performance out of it.
What kind of tuning are you talking about? Just good grain geometries?
The grain design is pretty simple. Like I said, it's just a cylinder with a hole down the axis, but you gotta size it right. And contrary to what a lot of people have claimed, the oxidizer injection mechanism is fairly critical too. We tried one because people insisted you could do it, where you just basically dumped a stream of LOX right down the center of the bore.
Right.
And it was terrible. It was rough, bad performance, a whole bit, which, it's what I kind of expected, but we had to do it to get people to shut up and let us do it the other way. So it did require an atomizing injector that would give you a fine spray of LOX so that the outgassing fuel could burn. It wouldn't burn with just a solid stream of liquid, or at least not very well. There's stuff like that.
Was the atomization all the way at the head end, or did you have to have like a tube where you had injected it? Did you have to do multi-port injection in order to?
We did do both. We started out just injecting in one end, and it became pretty clear to us that we could probably do a whole lot better if we would inject a percentage, and I don't remember the number anymore, but a percentage of the LOX down to the ullage, the downstream end of the grain, and that did substantially improve the performance.
Okay. Now, you guys were using liquid oxygen as your oxidizer, or were you using nitrous oxide?
Liquid oxygen. We were going for the best performance we could because we were going to orbit, and nitrous oxide is nice, and it's very convenient, and all this other stuff. Compared to LOX, the performance stinks. We couldn't afford to do that.
Right.
It's great for hobby rockets, but not, and it's even okay for, what's their name? Virgin. They're not really getting very high performance, since they don't really need it. They're going to orbit, it'd be a whole different ballgame.
Oh, certainly, yeah. But that they're using nitrous oxide because it's easier to tank, I would assume. They don't want to deal with the boil-off.
Well, yeah, I assume that's why. I don't know. Frankly, I don't find LOX all that difficult to get along with. But it probably has to do with the fact that they got to spend about 2 hours climbing to altitude hanging under the airplane. And with nitrous, they don't have to worry about keeping it liquid or about it boiling off. With LOX, you definitely would worry about boil off for that length of time.
Right. Now just...
But, you know, the B-52 and the B-29 that launched all those various X-planes, that's exactly what they did. They were loaded with LOX. But I think they did have a topping and an extra tank of LOX on board the bomber that could top it off. And I guess the Virgin people were trying to avoid that.
For more of this interview, go to the playlist and click on the next part.
Now, just for our listeners, I guess we got ahead of ourselves. Can you describe what the hybrid rocket is and why is it advantageous?
Well, the definition of a hybrid rocket means a bipropellant rocket of which one constituent is in solid form and the other constituent is in liquid, or in case of very small, gaseous form. And it can be either way. Conventionally, the solid element is the fuel, like the rubber we were using in AMROC, and the liquid is the oxidizer, the liquid oxygen. But there have been solid oxidizer liquid fuel hybrids built. That's hearsay. I have never actually seen one, but I understand that has been done, and I can certainly see how we could do it if we decided to.
And the idea is that with a solid, you once you get it lit, there's nothing else you can do. It has to run its course. But with a hybrid, you can throttle, or you can even shut it off, which is
and restart it.
Okay, right. And
you can actually shut down the solid motor if you're willing to dump enough water in it to quench the flame, but you probably can't restart it after doing that to it. The hybrid, if you've got an igniter, it's perfectly happy to run some more until it runs out of fuel.
Yeah, so since we're talking about the hybrids, I did look at some abstracts from papers that had been put out by AMROC back in the day. And okay. I noticed a couple times they asserted that hybrid rockets can't explode. I'm pretty positive that they can.
Well,
any thoughts on that?
Well, okay. Richard is saying that probably in some of the... These were in the abstracts you were saying, Richard? They were saying that hybrids have...
Yeah.
The hybrids do not have the ability to explode. I think that might...
Yeah.
I think that kind of borders on conjecture, but...
Well, here's the thing. If by explode you mean a chemical reaction propagates through the grain and that the whole thing blows up, no, that can't happen. However, looking at a hybrid the other way, is you have a very large pressure vessel full of very hot gas that's several thousand degrees and several hundred pounds per square inch. If that case happens to fail, the difference between that and it's just a high pressure explosion, although it's very hot gas. But the difference between that and the explosion where you've got stuff detonating is you probably wouldn't notice if you were standing right next to it. It's still pretty destructive. AMROC, after I was gone and George was gone, they had a very large motor that they were testing up at Edwards. I forget the size, but it was like, I don't know.
Right. I think they were targeting 250,000 pounds of thrust, I thought was their nominal target for their launch vehicle. Did that sound about right?
Yeah, I think that was right. But anyway, it blew up.
Was that?
Obviously, that motor didn't get the memo.
Right.
It don't blow up.
I think that's what Richard was driving at, was that.
Yeah, well, you know, there is the one particular kind of explosion like happens in a solid motor where the whole grain goes at once.
Right.
Cannot happen. However, what happened here was they didn't have the grain glued to the wall as well as they should have.
Oh.
And the hot gas got behind the grain and cut through the case to a critical length, and the whole case just opened up,
right,
peeled back like a banana. And, you know, all that several hundred pounds of hot gas that was in there came out. They found pieces of that rocket on top of their control center a couple hundred yards away. So it was a good enough explosion that I would not have wanted to be standing out there next to it.
Well, they certainly conducted it at the right place out at Edwards Air Force Base, hanging off the side of a mountain.
We did a lot of testing out there. We weren't running that big ones. We were running the ones we were going to use in our original so-called industrial launch vehicle. We got up to 30 or 33 Ks and went along in there. And generally they worked pretty well, but we did have some problems. One other thing I should mention, you will also hear people who know enough about rockets know that they have instability modes say, well, hybrids don't have any instability modes. In fact, when I was first recruited, I was told that by an old-timer from Thiokol, who I later started calling the great guru of hybrids because he was always calling me up to give me advice. And he said, there are no instability modes. Well, I got to tell you, I ran one hybrid test that has the honor of being the absolute most unstable, roughest running engine I have ever encountered in my 60-odd years in the business. It was the pressure. This sounds like a fib, but it's the God's honest truth. The pressure in the chamber was going from 0 to 200%, back to 0, back to 200% at about 60 hertz.
Oh, that's,
and you
that's
can imagine.
Insanity. That's insanity. Yeah.
Oh, it was crazy. And I, you know, it was a second or so before I was able to get it shut down. During that period, it broke two of the four tie downs. Just, you know, you can imagine the loads.
Right.
And if I'd been just a little tick slower on the button, why, we would probably have launched the confounded thing right out through the side of the test stand, and the Air Force would have been really PO'd at us.
Was it moving longitudinally? So, it was oscillating head to tail?
Yeah, mostly longitudinally, but just the whole everything about that is just a driving force at probably about the worst possible frequency, 60 hertz. You know, it's just like like bashing everything with a hammer. But on the other hand, once we learned what not to do, what to do, just like you always do in a program like that, and our hybrids were running quite well by the time the bottom fell out. So they did make good progress.
Right.
You asked me a question earlier, like, what did they actually accomplish? Well, they really did get far, far along in the technology of hybrid motors. And I think they did a service in doing that, because otherwise it always been kind of little people running little bitty toy hybrids and like that. These were big, real honest to God rocket engine hybrids, and they did well at that.
Yeah, they certainly did. I mean, now you had mentioned you had left the company after about a year and a half, and
right.
And then I think in the history I read that George Koopman had passed away as a result of injuries from a car accident that he was in, and
yeah. This was one of those the ironic things. George was absolutely one of the worst drivers I've ever seen. He just had no awareness of what to do. In fact, after the first couple of times we went on a business trip with George, Mike Griffin and I had a conference, and we went in and talked to him and said, "George, if we go on a trip with you where we rent a car, Mike or I will drive. We will not ride in the same car with you."
That's pretty
and
bold.
He says,
that's pretty bold words.
Or with you driving, I should say.
Yes.
And he said, okay, well, I'll have more time to talk on my satellite phone in the back seat. So, fine, do whatever you want to, just stay away from the wheel. And in fact, I remember saying one time, he's going to kill himself in the car. I just hope he doesn't take anyone with him. But, you know, you say that, people say that a lot, but
yeah.
This time it actually really, honest to goodness, happened.
That is really sad. I mean, it's sad to hear that with anybody, especially...
He and I did not get along well, but I didn't want to see him killed either.
Right.
You know, absolutely. I'm not quite that vindictive.
Now, just to be clear, when you say Mike Griffin, you mean who would become later NASA Administrator Mike Griffin.
And is now some kind of secretary in the Department of Defense. Yeah,
he certainly is. Yeah, his legacy at NASA was quite impressive. So that's quite a.
Mike and I met when I was at JPL, and he hired on there as a relatively young engineer. He had no real experience. He'd been doing machine coding for computers, and he wanted to get into space. And I got him on my Mars sample return study that I was heading. He came on as the guidance and control guy. And he and I hit it off. We had very much the same attitude about things and, interests and like that. So he and I got along really well and became close friends outside of work.
Well, that's great.
But then we were doing so well on that sample return study, and then NASA canceled it. And Mike got so mad, he resigned from JPL and went back east and went to work for Johns Hopkins APL.
Right.
And then later on, he became a consultant. He worked for APL before he came to JPL. Then he went to work for SDIO as a consultant. Strategic Defense Initiative.
Right.
And he did such a good job there that they promoted, that they actually hired him as a full-time as the deputy for technology in SDIO. And all the Air Force officers whom we had been helping said, "Well, what are we going to do? We need somebody, some technical guy to help us." And Mike says, "I've got just the guy for you." And he called me. So that's how I went from, Mike went from working for me to me working for Mike.
I see.
But I was consulting to SDIO for a number of years, which is really interesting because we did some really good high-tech stuff.
Yeah. I mean, we obviously the public hadn't been told a lot about it other than it was definitely something people were paying attention to at the end of the Cold War. It was a bargaining chip, I believe, at the Reykjavik conference when Reagan met with Gorbachev for the second time.
Yeah, a lot of people have said, and I have no way to know whether it's literally true or not, that the Russians were so afraid we were going to be successful with that they decided negotiation was the better part of valor, which could be, it's hard to know.
Well, it was certainly played beautifully by our former President Reagan. But you said Mike Griffin was brought to AMROC, what was his role over there?
He was basically the vehicle chief engineer. I was chief engineer for the company. He was, I forget the exact title, but basically chief engineer for vehicle development.
Oh, I see.
And he naturally did a great job at it. He's a very talented person.
Richard, did you have anything to add in?
Yeah, I guess there is one thing I'm curious about. When I've looked for, any sort of media on the company and on the internet, there's pretty sparse, there's a couple of pictures and I've never found any video. I mean, but there's got to be more of that kind of stuff out there somewhere.
Yeah, Richard, that's a good point. Richard comments that there really isn't a lot of tangible. there is some tangible proof about Amrock on the internet, but I think Amrock, the timing of when Amrock came to be, it predates a lot of that. There's some low res.
Oh yeah.
Photos and if anybody took the time to scan it, to scan some things in, I think AIAA really stands as the only real references for what Amrock accomplished, and they had several accomplishments. I assume you went to conference, Jim, for AIAA, on behalf of Amrock?
Yeah, I did. We published about three papers, not all of which were AIAA, during my tenure there. Mike and I and a guy named Joe Burke, who was in charge of president of one of our subcontractor companies. So, yeah, but, you know, as I said, I left in the 1987, and middle of that, and I just, you know, I'd have lying to investors and stuff like that. I will not do that. So, and George expected me to, and so we came to a parting of the ways. One day they ran out of money and missed the payroll. And Mike and I, who were both very dissatisfied, said, "This is the time." So we quit.
He
tried desperately to talk us into coming back, but I refused, because it was going to be the same old routine. You know, everything's great. We're going to fire and launch in 6 months. He'd been 6 months away from launch since I met him.
Right.
And when he said come back, and I said I won't. You know, I'm going to tell the truth if you want me back. He said, "Say anything you want to." I said, "If I say." You keep saying it. I said, "You keep saying 6 months to launch. It's not. You weren't 6 months from launch when the company shut down. Now that it's back together, how are you still 6 months from launch when you've lost half your people, et cetera, et cetera?" He says, "Say anything you want to." And I said, "How about I say 3 years?" He says, "That's unacceptable." And I said, "That's too bad," and left. Well, that was it. I never saw George again after that. After he died and the company was taken over by others, they did bring me back to do some consulting with them, primarily on vehicle design. But that was the extent of my working with them later on.
For more of this interview, go to the playlist and click on the next part.
The company then have coming back as a consultant after all those years, and because I know Amrock lasted quite a long time for a startup.
It
was really significant,
years.
All the way into the 90s, from the mid 80s into the 90s as Amrock was around.
Yeah, I don't know how long it was, but it could easily have been 10 years. Well, when I first started, George had this little entourage of people that I guess came with him from the Hollywood side, you know, and which is okay, except they weren't the kind of people you needed to run a company like this. And I mean, one of the things that set me aback was during a period of time when things weren't going well, I walked in the front door early in the morning and smelled smoke. Like, well, it doesn't smell like burning building. It smells like burning brush. And while I'm looking around, George's executive assistant comes parading down the hall, holding a bundle of some kind of herbs that are smoldering and smoking. I said, "What in the hell are you doing?" Or something polite like that. And she says, "This is to get rid of the bad vibes in the building." I thought, holy crap, here we are engaged in a high-tech facility or high-tech development program, and I've got witches wandering the hall casting spells.
Well, maybe they felt like they should cover all their bases.
I guess that's true, but somehow it didn't sit well with my engineering background.
Right, right.
But anyway, there were some hangers-on who were a little weird. Some people were really good, and you know, by, as we hired enough people, why it didn't matter too much. We did have some very good, capable people working there during my time toward the end, but George just couldn't pull the trigger on making enough money to support it, you know, to support the operation, and that's when they folded. And then somebody else came along with some money and
right.
Got things moving again. That's when I refused to come back. But then came the accident, and they put some guys in charge of it who were really quite capable. I can't remember their names anymore, but they were a good choice. They did a good job of pulling the company together, raising money and like that. But the bottom line is they still weren't going to make it. They, you know, you can make money or you to run along at a level, but you have to raise a whole lot of money to get when you really start, you know, making flight hardware and getting ready to launch and all that stuff. And they still weren't making. That's when they made the mistake a lot of small companies make. They got into bed with the elephants. And they had a contract to collaborate on a launch vehicle with Lockheed and...
Oh, with a larger contractor.
Yeah, two at Lockheed and Martin, back when those were still separate entities, I'm
right.
pretty sure. And one of them was going to do the guidance and control and stuff on the vehicle. The other one wanted to fly the very first aluminum lithium lock stack. And
oh,
which,
I see.
In fact, they almost did. And but the problem was AMROC entered into a deal where there was this much money that had to be attributed at a given time. And the two elephants, you know, to them, this was chump change. So they put theirs in. AMROC didn't make it. The whole thing folded and they had to close because they were,
oh.
you know, they were just squeezed out.
I see.
So you just don't, I really don't think a small company like that has much of a chance. And I'm not even sure there wasn't something deliberate about it. Maybe the big guys didn't want any competition. It's hard to know.
Well, but that, yeah. I
wanted
to bring that up, that AMROC, why AMROC was so fascinating to me was because it represented a specific time in the industry when there was passion for commercial spaceflight, but yet the NASA and many of the other, much in the government, they really weren't in favor of it. I wondered if AMROC had suffered from like active resistance from the very top.
I don't know. I didn't see any real active resistance, but there was no support either. I mean, the Air Force was pretty good. You know, they said we want to test on their test stands, and it's one they're not using. They're fine. They would work out, and they worked out a fairly equitable arrangement, so we could do that. And similarly, to the launch pad down at Vandenberg, the Air Force is pretty good about stuff like that. NASA, in my experience, tends to be a little less so.
Now, earlier you spoke of an accident. Were you referring to George Koopman's passing, or were you referring to AMROC made an attempt at a launch later in their career. Was that the accident you spoke of?
Well, the launch incident, that was the new company, the post Koopman company. And their idea was to launch a single solid motor, kind of like analogous to the Falcon 1, you know, which used one Falcon motor on the way to developing the Falcon 9, which used 9 of them. So they built this, and we had talked about doing that as well, as a test, just as a test flight for a motor. And what happened is the thing fired, but it didn't build up enough thrust to lift off the pad. And it just sat there, and the heat of the flames rising back up around it ignited the composite case and basically just sat there and burned itself to death.
Mm.
And apparently the reason for that was that they didn't put a purge on the oxidizer valve, which would have been dry nitrogen or possibly.
Right, to keep the moisture away from it.
And exactly. Out in the desert, they didn't have to worry about that, but they didn't think about the fact that they're going from 20% humidity to 90% humidity, right, down there, especially on cloud, you know, foggy days, which there are a lot of. And the thing collected enough water in there that it froze the valve, and it cracked open just enough to get a good fire going, but not enough to fly.
Right, and then ultimately consumed
the vehicle.
That, of course,
was the coup de grace.
Yeah.
Yes. It's kind of a shame, because I think it probably worked very well, but that was, you know, it's one of those, if you look at it in the brilliance of hindsight, you say, boy, that was a really bush league mistake, but I also recognize there was nobody there that had ever launched a rocket, and never, I don't think any of them had ever even, you know, launched anything, really, so it's... And I never worked in that kind of environment. So, you know, it was a mistake, and some people would say it was kind of a dumb mistake, but it's one that's easy to make, so I can't be too critical.
Right, and I guess that goes back to another common problem in startups is that they just simply don't have enough experienced people and just the right things that they need at the right time.
Yeah, they don't. There's an old saying is they don't know what they don't know.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. Hey, Richard, did you have anything more?
Yeah, the last question was thinking of covering was why do you think investors right up at the end? Because I remember reading that after their test failure, that, you know, a further investment was not forthcoming. I know that the satellite phone market was big for satellites, and that eventually dried up. I was wondering, you know, if you had any thoughts on why.
Right. Well, just to correct your timeline, I think the whole satellite phone market was a little bit later after AmRock had already folded. But your original question, yeah, Richard, still stands, that that I'm asking to Jim is you'd mentioned that they built up a launch vehicle. They got to a point where they had an all-out test, and even if it ended in failure, there were still many things gained. What do you think? Why do you think, Jim, that the funding dried up? That why even after?
I think the support was a little shaky all the time, just because the world wasn't ready for a private launch vehicle company quite yet, I think. And, you know, most people say, well, how could this little company do that? You know, the government has to do it. And of course, we all know that isn't true. But we were still running into the same thing when SpaceX and Blue Origin started their people, particularly people in NASA, would say, well, nobody but NASA can build rockets, you know, like,
right,
some kind of magic priesthood. And people in the, you know, just people that don't, on the street, so to speak, say, well, NASA does that. Other ordinary people can't do it. And it's the same people. The people that work for us are the people now, or the people that used to work for NASA or would be going to work for NASA. So it's not like there's some great superiority on one side of the fence or the other. In fact, most of the senior people at both Blue Origin and, as far as I know, at SpaceX are people that come from the industry, and even from NASA in some cases, and, you know, they've got the same smarts and ingenuity that they had before. What they don't have is quite such an onerous, such a big machine sitting on top of them telling them what to do.
NASA's very often, there's a difference between government and industry, but, I mean, the people are still people. The talent, maybe it's just the fact that, I think you hit on something there, that, you know, NASA, a lot of the average man on the street thinks that NASA builds rockets, and that's not true. NASA,
exactly.
NASA contracts with companies to build rockets, and those companies bring knowledgeable people together to do what the government asks them to do. And so if one company can do it, I think the average man on the street is right to ask, like, okay, if one company can get this much expertise in one place to do it, why can't another? And I guess that's the real question, is how does that knowledge get spread?
Well, it spreads by contact among people and all the usual mechanisms. But I think the difference now, between now and then, is there are people now with sufficient net worth to finance a program like Blue, Jeff Bezos at Blue, and Elon, although he's not running on his own money anymore, and Jeff still is. But, you know, the point is they had enough money to get the thing rolling and start doing a respectable job. And I think people are a lot more accepting of the whole concept of private enterprise in space than they were in 1986, 1987, when we were first trying with this other company. But it's difficult, and there are still people that don't think you can do it. And let's face it, SpaceX has mostly succeeded because they did, as I've often said, go over to the dark side and take government money. But Blue Origin can't be too righteous about it because they've got all sorts of government contracts.
Well, yeah, they certainly did. The Air Force gave them over $700 million for the launch services agreement. But I also don't look at that government money as necessarily being evil. I mean, it really just, it's the life's blood that keeps your organization running. The trouble is the money comes with strings, and do the strings get in the way? I don't know. The way I see it, SpaceX accomplished something that nobody had had before. They had success with a launch vehicle, but they had to take government money. But then again, the existing launch providers, the Boeings, the Lockheeds, they all did the same thing. They've just been doing it longer. Sure. They've just been doing it longer. So I really don't see the paradox. I don't know. What's your opinion, Jim?
I don't think there's a paradox. I mean, the government is a consumer, and this is just like saying, Boeing sells a lot of airplanes commercially, and they sell a lot of airplanes to the military. And in case of passenger carriers, it's basically the same airplane. So if the government stays as a customer, which is something they're trying to work in to be more of a customer and not running the show themselves, I think we'll be better off. The ideal world, they would set the requirements for what they need to do, and we, the companies in the outside world, figure out how we want to propose to do it and get picked if we do a good job. And that's exactly what's going on. So I was jokingly saying the dark side, because NASA gave us so much flack about the private enterprise and anybody but them building a launch vehicle. It was just intolerable.
Right.
And I got a little fed up with that, frankly, and that's what I mean by going over the dark side. That's really just a joke.
True. I guess it's funny how even a large organization can behave like a person in a fashion that be subject to whims such as jealousy or pride and certainly ego. But I'm waxing too philosophic here. We don't got a lot of time left for the show. I wanted to ask Richard, did you wanted to ask anything more about the subject of AMROC and with Jim French?
Oh, I think we've just about covered everything that I had lined up to ask.
Okay, great. Well, at this point, I'm going to turn it back over to Alistair for the closing remarks, but we've got your email, Jim, and it's been a real pleasure talking with you about AMROC, because I really think that AMROC represented a key point in time when it came to space startups. So I'll pass you on here to Alistair.
I think it did.
Yeah, it's been great having you on.
All right, thank you so much, Jim, for joining us today on the show. I really appreciate you firing a rocket with me as well. The information that we get from you, the experiences, it's priceless. Richard, thank you so much also for being a part of the show and having your input with the subject of Amarok. Okay, so until we get to talk again, Mr. French, hopefully I'll get to see you sometime soon, maybe at one of the conventions or something. It's always a pleasure seeing you as well. Oh yeah, we are actually having the Reaction Research Symposium next year. I believe we're targeting March, if I'm not mistaken. But you know, we have your email, so we'll definitely communicate that to you. Hopefully we'll get to see you there.
Good. I'd like to do it if I possibly can.
Wonderful. Well, again, thank you so much. It's a pleasure. And that's a wrap, Richard.
My pleasure.
All right.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day. Goodbye.